I'm Ray.
And I'm Charlotte.
And this is The Midnight Record.
The Midnight Record.
Ready to rock and roll.
Barely alive.
Well, yeah. We've recorded, this is episode number 4 that we've recorded today.
Yep.
We have a couple weeks where schedules just don't align, so we're just banging them out in one day. We're getting a little wild in the studio today.
So definitely our brains are slowly but surely.
What brain?
Yeah, I don't have one anymore.
It's There's nothing.
And yeah, we're about. I'm about to talk for a while.
Yeah. So. And yet we have a Charlotte-driven episode for you today.
Yes, we do.
And what are we going to be talking about, though?
Today we're going to be talking about David Berkowitz, also known as the Son of Sam.
That guy.
I want to do this episode now because we are just around the 45th anniversary of the first killing of. David Berkowitz.
That's wild.
This is like the 45th anniversary, almost.
Yeah.
For the most part. Yeah, let's waste no time.
Let's dive in.
Let's just dive in.
Dive right on in.
Ray's like, I don't know how I'm going to survive.
I'm chilling.
You're okay.
Just ready for Mr. Berkowitz to just grace me with his presence.
Absolutely. All right. Well, let's start then. David Berkowitz, who was born as Richard David Falco, was born on June 1st, 1953 in Brooklyn, New York. His mother, Betty Broder, grew up as a part of an impoverished Jewish family, and as a waitress. She married Tony Falco, an Italian-American, in 1936, and after a marriage of less than 4 years, Tony Falco left her for another one.
As they do.
Yeah. In 1950, Broder started a relationship with a married man named Joseph Kleiman. 3 years later, she became pregnant with a child who she then ended up naming Richard David Falco. Before Berkowitz was even a week old, he was put up for adoption. Although her reasons for doing this are pretty unknown, writers have thought that Kleiman threatened to abandon her if she had kept the baby and used his name.
Yeah.
Yeah. So unfortunately, but that happened all the time with, like, children out of wedlock back then.
And it's crazy that she had her husband leave her for another woman, and then she went for a married man.
Yep.
Like, girl, you know how it feels. Don't do that.
Don't do it. David was placed in the care of hardware store owners Nathan and Pearl Berkowitz of the Bronx, and they reversed his first and middle names and gave him their own surname, raving young David Richard Berkowitz as their only child. Mm-hmm. And they gave him a fairly normal upbringing. He was large for his age, and David felt different and unattractive most of the time. He was hyperactive, which was difficult for his adoptive parents to control, and he enjoyed baseball. When he was 5 years old, he would sometimes take showers with Nathan, and the following year, he noticed the power that men have over women after seeing a man enter the women's side of a bathhouse, frightening the current occupants of the women's side.
Ew.
Yeah, I'm not.
It's fucking gross.
That's called sexual harassment, ladies and gentlemen.
Yes.
And babies. In 1960, Berkowitz had two separate incidents in which he suffered head injuries, when he was hit by a car and then when he ran into a wall. The following year, he was hit in the head with a pipe and suffered a 4-inch-long gash along his forehead. So he had 3 head injuries.
Right. Which, isn't that something they attribute to a lot of killers?
Yes, they do. Absolutely. It's usually a part of the formula, unfortunately. Yeah. When he was 12 years old, Berkowitz began to set fires and then started torturing and killing animals the following year, usually killing bugs by burning and gluing them with rubber cement.
Oh, yay. What a fun science experiment.
I mean, literally.
Like, he is the prototype.
Textbook definition.
Of, like, all the things that they say to look out for.
Yep, pretty much.
Cool.
Later, the Berkowitzes moved away to get away from the changing neighborhood they lived in, but Pearl ended up dying of breast cancer on October 5th, 1967, when David was 14 years old.
R.I.P. Pearl.
Really sad. After that, Berkowitz began deteriorating, his average grades declining, and his religious beliefs wavering. He was also getting teased for being overweight and became antisocial. His home life became strained during the later years, particularly because he disliked his adopted father's second wife. Mm-hmm. But in 1971, he graduated from high school and joined the U.S. Army on June 23rd, serving in the U.S. and in South Korea. During his service, Berkowitz began using drugs and got into trouble frequently, and he began to set fires again after a long period of inactivity.
Yay.
I know, right? It's like, great!
Yay, more fires.
After 3 years, he was honorably discharged in 1974 and held down a number of blue-collar jobs, including a security guard position and was also a taxi driver. In one incident of the former job, he was bitten by a dog, which presumably fueled future delusions that involved dogs.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah. He also enrolled in Bronx Community College in 1975. That same year, Berkowitz was reunited with his birth mother and learned the details of his conception, eventually starting a relationship with her. However...
Wait. A mother-son relationship?
Like, yeah, like a familial. No, not like a romantic relationship.
Oh,
no,
Lord.
No.
Scared me. I was like, I did not know this. Too far.
No. No incest here.
Okay.
That we know of. Yeah. However, he was greatly disturbed by this knowledge, and he eventually stopped seeing his mom, but remained in touch with his half-sister, Rosalyn. On August 28th, presumably in response to learning about his real heritage, Berkowitz began setting a series of fires in New York City, which gradually grew worse by June of the following year. So from August of 1975 to June of 1976, just got worse and worse. By that time, he was hired as a security guard for the John F. Kennedy International Airport, but decided to quit after saying he heard voices of dogs accompanying him through his shift.
Okay.
These delusions began to grow worse, and by November of 1975, he allegedly started listening to them, which would eventually lead to his serial killings. At that time, Berkowitz slid into a deep depression, and at the time of his arrest, he was employed by the U.S. Postal Service. His eventual arrest.
Mm-hmm.
Spoiler alert. So New York City used to be called Fun City by the mayor and by marketing teams for New York City, but it very quickly in the mid-70s turned into Fear City, which is also a really great Netflix documentary series.
Hmm.
In 1975, 11,000 crimes were reported, one for every 15 residents. 4,000 of these crimes were either assaulted, robbed, raped, or murdered. And the mayor had actually, which was Mayor Abraham Beam at the time, had laid off over 10,000 police officers due to city financial problems. Crime went up to over 20% of that year from the previous year.
Mm.
So that is the year before his crimes started.
Right.
And if that just gives you an idea of like how bad the city was at that point. Like when people ask me, especially people of like a certain age, if I may say, ask me if I feel unsafe in New York City, I'm like, they're thinking of the New York from like the 70s,
yes,
when, you know, you had like the Deuce and like Times Square being a really sketchy place. Like, it's not like that anymore.
Mm-hmm. Things still happen, obviously, but it's not like as rampant as it was then.
No. I mean, nowhere is really that safe, but it's not nearly as bad as what it used to be.
Mm-hmm.
Berkowitz has claimed that his first attacks were on Christmas Eve 1975 when he was 22, and he committed a knife attack on two women just a day after he set his last fire. Both of them were have said to have survived. One alleged victim, which was a Hispanic woman, was never identified by the police, but the other was was 15-year-old Michelle Foreman, a sophomore at Truman High School, whom he attacked on a bridge near Dreiser Loop, which is in the Bronx, and whose injuries were serious enough for her to be hospitalized for 7 days. Berkowitz was not suspected of these crimes, and soon afterwards, he relocated to an apartment in Yonkers, New York, just north of New York City. It was about 20 to 25 minutes outside of Co-op City, which is near the area that he like grew up in. The killing spree that would make him infamous began on the streets of New York in the summer of 1976. Okay, so we're going to go attack by attack. The first shooting attributed to the son of Sam occurred in the Pelham Bay area of the Bronx, sort of like Central East Bronx. At about 1:10 a.m. on July 29, 1976, Donna Loria, an emergency medical technician who was 18 years old, and her friend Jody Valente, who was a nurse, 19 years old, were sitting in Valente's Double Park Oldsmobile discussing their evening at Peachtree's, which was a discotheque in New Rochelle.
Fancy.
Donna opened the car door to leave and noticed a man quickly approaching the car. Startled and angered by the man's sudden appearance, she apparently said, "Now, what is this?" Which I'm like, same.
Now, what is this?
What is this?
I say that about every day.
What is this? The man produced a pistol from a paper bag that he carried and crouched. He braced one elbow on his knee and aimed his weapon with both hands and fired. Donna was struck by one bullet that killed her instantly. Jody was shot in her thigh, and a third bullet missed both women. The shooter turned and walked away quickly. Jody survived her injury and said she did not recognize the killer. She described him as a white male in his 30s with a fair complexion, about 5'8" tall and weighing around 200 pounds. His hair was short, dark, and curly in a mod style. This description was repeated by Donna's father, who claimed to have seen a man sitting in a yellow compact car nearby. Neighbors gave corroborating reports to police that an unfamiliar yellow compact car had been cruising the area for hours before the shooting. Years later, in 1993, journalist Maury Terry interviewed Berkowitz at the Sullivan Correctional Facility, in which Berkowitz admitted that it was himself who shot Loria and Valenti. Then on October 23rd, 1976, Berkowitz went to Flushing, Queens and attacked another couple sitting in a parked car. Carl DeNaro, a Citibank security guard 20, and Rosemary Keenan, a Queens College student who was 18 years old, were sitting in Rosemary's parked car when the windows suddenly shattered. "I felt the car explode," Carl said later. Rosemary quickly started the car and sped away for help. The panicked couple did not realize that someone had been shooting at them, even though Carl was bleeding from a bullet wound in his head.
Damn.
Yeah.
He didn't realize he was shot?
No.
Oh, wow.
He didn't realize that, like, he had, like, blood running down right. his face. And in later interviews, Carl actually says that he sort of blacked out and woke up at, like, 4 o'clock in the morning in the hospital with his whole head wrapped.
Right.
And he told the police officer at the time, like, "Oh, as long as I'm home by 7 a.m., my mom will never know that I was out, so I need to get going." And the police officer's like, "Son, you're not going home. You've been shot in the head, sir.
Let's relax.
To stay here, okay,
let's
bud?
Let's relax." I think that's the least of your worries.
Right. Rosemary only had superficial injuries from the broken glass, but Carl eventually needed a metal plate to replace a portion of his skull. Mm. He was, like, hit sort of on the back, the back right-hand side of his head from the pictures that I saw.
Right.
Neither victim saw the attacker. Police determined that the bullets embedded in Rosemary's car were from a .44 caliber, but they were so deformed when they found them that they thought it was likely that they could never be linked to a particular weapon. Mm. Carl had shoulder-length hair at the time, and police later speculated that the shooter had mistaken him for a woman. Rosemary's father was a 20-year veteran police detective of the New York City Police Department, who caused an intense investigation. As the Loria Valenti shooting, however, there seemed not to be a motive for the shooting, and police made very little progress with the case. Mm-hmm. Many details of the DeNaro-Keenan shooting were very similar to the Loria Valenti case, but police did not initially associate them, particularly because the shootings occurred in different boroughs and were investigated by different local police precincts, which is something that we always talk about. Mm-hmm. And also, both of these cases didn't really get a whole lot of publicity in the news.
It's because so much was going on.
There was so much already going on that it sort of became like a side note.
Right.
So there are articles online about the first shootings involving Donna and Jody, and it just says, like, Bronx girl killed in random shootout or something like that, and that's all, like, really came of it.
Yeah.
And this one also had a very, like, had a very small blip in the newspaper as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to move on to November 1976. Just over a month later, on November 27th, 1976, he shot teenagers Donna DeMasi and Joanne Lomino when they were walking home from a trip to the cinema. They were chatting on the porch of Joanne's home in Floral Park when a man in military fatigues who seemed to be in his early 20s approached them and began to ask them for directions. So I want you guys to remember that they're saying that he's in his early 20s, whereas Jody described him in his 30s. Mm. In a high-pitched voice, he said, "Can you tell me how to get..." but then quickly produced a revolver. He shot each of the victims once as they fell to the ground injured. He shot several more times, striking the apartment building before running away. A neighbor heard the gunshots, shouted out of the apartment building, and saw a blonde man, rush by gripping a pistol in his left hand. Mm-hmm. Donna had been shot in the neck, but the wound was not life-threatening. Joanne had been hit in the back and hospitalized in serious condition. She survived, but was ultimately rendered paraplegic. Mm. Which is really, really sad.
Yeah.
This is right before shit really starts hitting the fan. So again, at this point, they still don't even realize that the three shootings are connected at all. Berkowitz took a couple of months off, but then on January 30th, 1977, he started his shootings again. This attack was on engaged couple Christine Freund, a secretary who was 26, and her fiance John Deal, who was a bartender, 30 years old. They were sitting in John's car near the Forest Hills Long Island Railroad Station in Queens, preparing to drive to a dance hall after they had seen the movie Rocky. Three gunshots penetrated the car. In panic, John drove away for help. He suffered minor superficial injuries, but Christine had been shot twice and died several hours later at the hospital. Neither victim had seen their attacker. It was after this attack that the police determined that the weapon used in the shootings was a .44 caliber Charter Arms Bulldog. The weapons used in the other shootings were similar, so they began to suspect the shootings were connected, and they gave the shooter the nickname the .44 caliber killer. The police also made the connection that the shootings targeted young women with long dark hair and or young couples parked in cars. Composite sketches were released of the black-haired Loria Valenti shooter and the blonde Lomio DeMasi shooter, and police started looking for multiple suspects, not just one suspect. Mm. On March 8th, 1977, Berkowitz shot Virginia Voskarichian as he walked by her car, and she died on the spot. She was 19 years old. She lived about a block away from where Christine Freund has been shot, so in that Forest Hills area of Queens. Mm-hmm. In a desperate move to defend herself, Virginia lifted her textbooks between herself and her killer, but the makeshift shield was penetrated, and the bullet struck her in the head and killed her. Once again, the bullet came from a .44 caliber gun. With this information, the police and the New York City mayor at the time, Abraham Beam, went public on March 10, 1977, and announced that the same .44 caliber gun had been used in a number of shootings. The media went in an uproar and began following every little detail so that the stories that they published could become more and more sensationalized. The crimes were discussed by the local media virtually every day. Circulation increased dramatically for the New York Post and Daily News, newspapers with graphic crime reporting and commentary. Foreign media featured many of the reports as well, including the front page articles of newspapers such as the Vatican's L'Osservatore Romano, the Hebrew paper Morav, and the Soviet Izvestina. I'm sorry if I mispronounced any of those.
I know that was it.
come for me in the DMs, baby.
You nailed it.
Just as a side note, personal note, around this time, my mother was spending some time in New York City, and she has long, dark brown hair, and she was very on edge because this was when they started saying, like, a lot of women started getting their hair cut short or dyed a different color.
Mm-hmm. She fit the profile.
She fit the profile, baby.
Ooh, yikes.
Definitely fit the profile.
Honestly, I probably would have been cutting my hair and dyeing it.
I would have probably been wearing wigs or something, yeah.
Shaved it right off.
I don't know what I would have done. Hopefully we never have to be in that situation, right. But...
Ugh, No redhead killers, please.
No redhead killers. No, none.
No, thank you.
At about 3 o'clock in the morning on April 17th, 1977, Alexander Iso, a tow truck operator who was 20 years old, and Valentina Suriani, a Lehman College student, and an aspiring actress and model who was 18 years old, were sitting in a car belonging to Iso's brother on the Hutchinson River Parkway service road in the Bronx, about a block from the girl's home and only a few blocks away from the scene of the Loria Valenti shooting. So it seems like he's, like, going back to the same areas now, yeah. Now that he knows that he can get away with it.
Right, he's becoming comfortable in these areas.
Too comfortable, right. Some might say.
Too comfy.
A resident of a nearby building heard 4 shots and called the police. Valentina, who was sitting in the driver's seat, had been shot once, and Alexander was shot twice, both in the head. Valentina died at the scene, and Alexander died at the hospital several hours later without being able to describe his attacker or attackers. Police said that the weapon used for the crime scene was the same as the one that they had suspected in earlier shootings. On September 23, 1993, in an interview with Maury Terry at the Sullivan Correctional Facility, Berkowitz admitted that he was the one who committed this crime as well as the first crime. Mm. So in 93, he has this huge interview with Maury Terry, who wrote The Ultimate Evil. David Berkowitz only admits to some of the killings, not all of the killings, which is, again, very important to note. We're going to get into the Son of Sam letters. And yeah, we'll put on the Instagram two of the most infamous letters that David Berkowitz wrote. The first one was to Captain Joe Borelli of the Operation Omega, who was the task force that was set up to investigate the shootings. A police officer actually found this note near the bodies of Alexander and Valentina, and it was addressed to the captain. And in this letter, David Berkowitz describes himself as a monster and taunted the police for not being able to catch him yet. Mm-hmm. Some of the letter says, "I am deeply hurt by your calling me a woman hater. I am not, but I am a monster. I am the Son of Sam. I am a little brat. When Father Sam gets drunk, he gets mean. He beats his family. Sometimes he ties me up to the back of the house. Other times he locks me in the garage. Sam loves to drink blood. Go out and kill, commands Father Sam." And so on and so forth. Yay. You can read more of it if you would like to. There is also a portion of this same letter that says, "Mr. Borelli, sir, I don't want to kill anymore. No, sir, no more, but I must honor thy father," quote unquote. "To the people of Queens, I love you, and I want to wish you all a happy Easter. May God bless you in this life and in the next. And for now, I say goodbye and goodnight."
Wow, that's sweet.
I'll be back. Bang, 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 ugh. Yours in murder, Mr. Monster.
Wow, fun guy.
Very...
a poet.
Truly a poet. With this letter, Berkowitz revealed the name Son of Sam for the first time. The press had previously dubbed the killer the .44 caliber, previously discussed, because of the weapon of choice. Mm-hmm. But now they started calling him the Son of Sam because of this letter.
Right.
Psychologists observe that many serial killers gain gratification by eluding pursuers and observers. The feeling of control of media, law enforcement, and even population provides a source of social power for them, because so many are social outcasts.
Right.
After consulting with several psychiatrists, police released the psychological profile of their suspect on May 26, 1977. He was described as a neurotic and probably suffering from paranoid schizophrenia, and believed himself to be a victim of demonic possession. 4 days later, on May 30th, 1977, columnist Jimmy Breslin of the New York Daily News, who was known as, like, the true crime guy at the time, also received a handwritten letter from David Berkowitz. Underneath the Son of Sam was a logo or sketch that combined several symbols. The writer's question, "What will you have for July 29th, was considered an ominous threat. July 29th would be the anniversary of the first .44 caliber killer shooting. I'm also going to read just a tiny bit of this letter as well. This letter actually was ended up posted to the New York Daily News, but there were portions of it that were not released.
Right.
Part of the portions that were not released had specific names in reference to potential accomplices, such as the Duke of Death, the Wicked King of Wicker, which is also like a reference to the Wicker Man, the 22 Disciples of Hell, John Wheaties. And at the very end, it says, here are some names to help you along. Forward them to the inspector for use by the NCIC. That's where the Duke of Death went. That's where all that stuff. So, yeah. And then at the very end, it says, P.S. JB, please inform the detectives working the slayings to remain. Like, to remain on the case, I assume. And the NCIC is the National Crime Information Center.
Mm-hmm.
Breslin immediately notified the police, who thought the letter was probably from someone with knowledge of the shootings, because the handwriting in the first letter and the handwriting in the second letter are very different.
Mm-hmm.
The Breslin letter was sophisticated in its wording and presentation, especially when compared to the crudely written first letter. And the police suspected that it might have been created in an art studio or a similar professional location by someone with expertise in printing, calligraphy, or graphic design. After getting advice from the police, the paper published it after agreeing with the police to withhold portions of the text, which is some of the portions that I just read.
Mm-hmm.
And Breslin urged the killer in this article to surrender himself. The letters changed David Berkowitz's name once again in the media from the .44 caliber killer to the Son of Sam. Police received thousands of tips based on references in the publicized portions of the letter, all of which proved completely useless. All were dead ends. All of them were blind alleys. All the shooting victims to date had long, dark hair, and thousands of women in New York acquired short cuts or brightly colored dyes, and beauty supply stores had trouble meeting the demand for wigs.
Mm-hmm.
What we were just saying earlier.
Yeah. Makes sense.
On June 26, 1977, there was another shooting. Sal Lupo, a mechanic's helper who was 20 years old, and Judy Placido, a recent high school graduate who was 17 years old, had left the Elphys Discotheque in Bayside, Queens. I love these discotheques.
Yeah.
Sal was wounded in the right forearm, while Judy was shot in the right temple, shoulder, and back of her neck. Both victims survived their injuries. Sal told police that the young couple had been discussing the Son of Sam case only moments before they were shot at.
That's creepy.
I know, right?
Yeah.
Very odd. Neither Sal nor Judy had seen their attacker, but two witnesses reported a tall, dark-haired man in a leisure suit fleeing the area. One claimed to see him leave in a car and even supplied a partial license plate number.
Hey there, I'm Tara.
And I'm Jessica, and together we co-host the podcast Three Spooked Girls.
If you love the paranormal
or murder,
join us on Mondays for full-length episodes where we discuss our favorite paranormal stories and true crime cases.
And join us again on Thursdays for our mini-sodes called Stabby Snippets, where we tell you all about true crimes happening in the news.
You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, Spotify, wherever the hell else you listen to your pods at. You can also find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook by using the handle at Three Spooked Girls.
Come and hang out with us and get your spooky on while we scare the hell out of you. The Three Spooked
Girls. So far as descriptions go, we've had a short, dark-haired man.
Mm-hmm.
We've had a
blonde,
medium-height blonde man. And now we have a tall man in a tall, dark-haired man in a leisure suit.
Right. So we're getting a lot of conflicting descriptions here.
Very conflicting. I'm sorry, but, like, if you look at Berkowitz, like, there's no way that his hair could have been mistaken for blonde.
Right.
There's no way.
Right.
No way.
Unless he had a wig on.
Exactly. Which wouldn't have gone so that far, I don't think.
Right.
With the first anniversary of the initial .44 caliber shootings approaching, the police established an area that emphasized past hunting grounds in Queens and the Bronx. However, the next and final .44 shooting occurred in Brooklyn. So now he's going outside of his original safe space, if you will. Early on July 31st, 1977, Stacy Moskowitz, a secretary, and Robert Violente, a clothing store salesman, both who were 20, were in Robert's car, which was parked under a streetlight near a city park in the neighborhood of Bath Beach on their first date. They were kissing when a man approached within 3 feet of the passenger side of Robert's car and fired 4 rounds into the car, striking both victims in the head before he escaped into the park. A man named Tommy Zino was a witness of the shooting. Robert lost his left eye. Stacy, the only blonde victim of Berkowitz's, died from her injuries.
Interesting.
Yeah. That night, Detective John Felicito was awoken at his home and was told to report to the 10th Homicide Division at the 60th Precinct Station House in Coney Island, which is like relatively close to Bath Beach.
Mm-hmm.
He was given 2 weeks to work on the Moskowitz-Violente case as a normal murder investigation. If it could not be solved in that time frame, it was going to be given to the Son of Sam task force. Now we're going to go into the suspicion slash capture moment. Thank God.
Mm-hmm. we've had about enough.
Yeah, enough with the killings.
Enough with this.
The same evening of the Moskowitz-Violente shooting, Cecilia Davis, who lived near the crime scene, had witnessed a man remove a parking ticket from his car that had been parked too close to a fire hydrant. The event had been taking place right before the killing. Cecilia felt concerned because he was wielding in his hand some kind of quote-unquote dark object. She ran to her home only to hear shots fired behind her in the street. Cecilia remained silent about this experience for 4 days.
Mm.
4 days.
Ma'am.
Until she finally contacted the police, who closely checked every car that had been ticketed in that area that night. But I'm like, girl, why'd you wait 4 days?
She was sleepy.
Fool. A fool,
I say. She was busy.
A fool.
She was tired.
Busy for what? Not too busy for murder. Putting two and two together, the police assumed that whoever had gotten the ticket must have been a witness to the shootings. Berkowitz's 1970 four-door yellow Ford Galaxy, I like that name, was amongst the cars that they had investigated. On August 9th, 1977, so only 9 days after the last shooting, NYPD Detective James Justice telephoned Yonkers Police to ask them to schedule an interview with Berkowitz. The Yonkers police dispatcher who first took Justice's call was Wheat Carr, the daughter of Sam Carr, and the sister of Berkowitz's alleged cult confederates, John and Michael Carr. Don't worry, we'll get into the cult stuff in a minute. When the name David Berkowitz came up in the connection with the car, it came to light that the police in Yonkers had Berkowitz in the frame as a suspect for some of the crimes referenced in one of the Son of Sam letters.
Mm-hmm.
Yonkers investigators even told New York City detectives that Berkowitz might be the Son of Sam. The next day, on August 10th, 1977, the police investigated Berkowitz's car that was parked on the street outside of his apartment building at 35 Pine Street in Yonkers. They saw a gun in the back seat, searched the car, and found a duffel bag with ammunition, maps of the crime scenes, and a threatening letter addressed to Inspector Tommy Dowd of the Omega Task Force. Much suspicious. Very suspicious. Police decided to wait for Berkowitz to leave the apartment rather than risk a violent encounter in the building's narrow hallway. And they were also waiting to obtain a search warrant for his apartment, worried that their search might be challenged in court, which is a very fair worry.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen plenty of cases be thrown out because they didn't have the proper warrants or whatever. The initial search of the vehicle was based on the handgun that was visible in the backseat. Although possession of such a gun was legal in New York State and required no special permit, the warrant had not arrived when Berkowitz exited the apartment building at around 10 p.m. that night and entered his car. Berkowitz was arrested that same night when he was coming out of his apartment. His first words in the moments were, "Well, you got me." Looking through his apartment, they found satanic graffiti on the walls and a diary in which he claimed responsibility for several arsons. After a brief and wordless encounter, Mayor Beam, announced to the media, "The people of the city of New York can rest easy because of the fact that police have captured a man whom they believe to be the son of Sam." Berkowitz was interrogated for about 30 minutes in the early morning of August 11th, 1977. He quickly confessed to the shootings and expressed an interest in pleading guilty. The investigation was led by John Keenan, who took the confession. So John is the father of one of his previous victims. Mm-hmm. Which I don't think would fly now, because he would just be, like, too close to the case, but
right.
He got to be a part of it then, so. During questioning, Berkowitz claimed that his neighbor's dog was one of the reasons that he had started killing, and the dog demanded the blood of pretty young girls. So this is when the whole Sam, demonic dog, right. I am possessed, I'm crazy thing starts happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are Berkowitz's words.
Right.
Because he was trying to not have to stand trial for, like, reasons of insanity.
Right.
He said that the Sam mentioned in his first letter was his former neighbor, Sam Carr. Berkowitz claimed that Harvey, Carr's black Labrador retriever, was possessed by an ancient demon, and it issued irresistible commands that Berkowitz must kill people.
Tongue twister.
I'm telling you. A few weeks after his arrest and confession, Berkowitz was permitted to communicate with the press. In a letter to the New York Post dated September 19, 1977, Berkowitz alluded to his original story of demonic possession, but closed with a warning that has been interpreted by some investigators as an admission of criminal accomplices. Quote, "There are other sons out there. God help the world," unquote. That's not ominous at all.
No.
At a press conference in February of 1979, however, Berkowitz declared that his previous claims of demonic possession were a hoax. Mm-hmm. Berkowitz stated in a series of meetings with his special court-appointed psychiatrist, David Abrahamson, that he had long contemplated murder to get revenge on the world that he felt had rejected and hurt him. We're going to go into the trial briefly. It's not super intense, but there are some interesting things that happen during his sentencing and trial. Three separate mental health examinations determined that Berkowitz was competent to stand trial. Despite this, defense lawyers advised Berkowitz to enter a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity, but Berkowitz refused. He appeared calm in court on May 8, 1978, as he pled guilty to all of the shootings. At his sentencing 2 weeks later, Berkowitz caused an uproar as he attempted to jump out of a window out of the seventh floor courtroom.
Try to pull Bundy.
Very Bundy-like, right? Mm-hmm. But I think Bundy happened after. Bundy, yeah, I was definitely gonna say. Happened. So Bundy was pulling Bundy. A Berkowitz.
He did. He did.
During the trial, he kept chanting in a low but audible volume, "Stacy was a whore," presumably referring to Stacy Moskowitz, last murder victim, and shouted, "I'd kill her again. I'd kill them all again." The court ordered another psychiatric examination before sentencing could proceed. During the evaluation, Berkowitz drew a sketch of a jailed man surrounded by numerous walls. At the bottom, he wrote, "I am not well. I am not well at all." Nevertheless, Berkowitz was again found competent to stand trial. On June 12, 1978, Berkowitz was sentenced to 25 years to life in prison for each murder to be served consecutively. He was ordered to serve time in the Attica Correctional Facility in upstate New York's Supermax prison. Despite prosecutors' objections, the terms of Berkowitz's guilty plea made him eligible for parole in 25 years.
Okay. Perfect.
Spoiler alert, he's still in jail. Yay. So don't have to worry about it. And actually, he's, like, very comfortable being in jail.
Good. I'm glad he's having a great time.
Well, I'm glad he's staying there.
Yeah, I'm glad he's not trying to get out.
After his sentencing, there were rumors that Berkowitz had been approached by movie studios and publishers about the rights to his story. As a result, the state of New York instituted what's now known as the Son of Sam's Laws, which prevents convicted criminals from profiting from their stories. The same laws were also used to keep Mark David Chapman, the assassin of John Lennon, from doing so as well. Which Berkowitz was going to try to make money off of this. He was going to try to sell his story. Mm-hmm. And thank God the state of New York, like, set to him and was like, hold on, please. Whoa, 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 whoa. Like,
no.
No, ma'am.
Yes, sir.
Berkowitz is currently serving time at the Sullivan Correctional Facility for his 6 murders as well as his attempted murders. Mm-hmm. In 1987, after a few troublesome years, he declared himself a born-again Christian. Mm-hmm. And has remained as such ever since. According to his testimony, his moment of conversion occurred after reading Psalm 34:6 from the Bible given to him by a fellow inmate, which goes as follows. This poor man cried, and the Lord heard him and saved him out of all of his troubles.
Okay. That was uneventful.
I was going to say unclimactic for sure.
Anticlimactic
for sure. He says he no longer wants to be referred to as the son of Sam, but the son of hope.
Oh, no.
Sorry, buddy. You don't get to choose what people are going to refer to you as because you are what?
A loser.
A murderer. And a loser.
Not the son of hope. Goodbye. Goodbye.
I don't want to be known as the son of Sam. I want to be known as the son of hope.
He's so hopeful.
You don't get to make
those. You don't get to pick and choose.
You don't get to pick. You don't get to pick, buddy. No. You don't get to pick. First of all, you already got to pick your name the first time
around.
Right.
You're lucky.
Because they gave you the .44 caliber killer.
Right.
And then they start calling
you
the son
of Sam. You said, no, son of Sam, please.
Yeah, exactly. So you already got your pick. You get one. That's it. That's all you get.
That's it.
So he has continued to write essays on faith. And repentance for Christian websites, a website maintained on his behalf by a church group, since he is not allowed access to a computer.
So a church group is writing this up for him?
Yeah, so I assume he's writing it by hand, and then they go and they put it on their blog.
Lovely. Great. How nice of them.
Look, I fully believe that people are allowed to change. Like, I fully believe that people do change. And I'm not saying that he hasn't changed or feels remorse for what he's done. Mm. But also through that, he does not get to make demands.
Right.
On how people then perceive him. Yeah, he doesn't get that.
Right.
Sorry, you just don't.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, nobody does.
Right. And I mean, he also killed a bunch of people. Like, these people aren't coming back. Yeah, you can, I guess, start to feel remorse and change per se, but
the oldest person that he killed was Sal Lupo, who was only 30. Mm-hmm. We're 30.
Yeah.
It's like, Sal still had so much more life ahead of him.
Yeah.
So did all those other people. Mm-hmm. Hey, I will say, at least he's not doing the thing where he's trying to, like, repent the families.
Right.
Like, I also feel like sometimes that is masturbatory for the criminal.
Mm-hmm.
Berkowitz stays involved with prison ministry and regularly counsels troubled inmates. David is entitled to a parole hearing every 2 years as mandated by state law. Though he has consistently refused to ask for his release, sometimes he skips the hearings altogether. In 2018, the board again denied the release of Berkowitz on parole. His next hearing was scheduled for May 2020. But due to the COVID-19 pandemic, his hearing was delayed until further notice. Mm-hmm. He said in interviews, he's like, I'm happy to be here. Like, I can't be back out. And so he's been there for so long at this point.
Right.
He's been in jail for over 40 years.
Right.
Like, he can't, sorry, like, as we have previously discussed, our prisons are not built for
reentering society.
Well, they're not built for rehabilitation.
Right.
At all. As much as some prisons like to promote that, they just aren't.
Right.
So I'm glad that he's found his faith, and I'm glad that he's found peace, and I'm glad that he is trying to make peace with his maker over things that he has done. Mm. And honestly, I think by him skipping his parole hearings, and he needs to keep doing that.
Right.
Because if he's truly happy, like, being in prison, then, like, just let him stay in prison, guys.
Right.
So that's where David Berkowitz is currently. I'm going to very briefly touch on the satanic cult theory that surrounds the Son of Sam. There has been a new 4-part documentary series on Netflix, which I highly, highly, highly recommend watching. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's 4 parts. They're an hour long each. They've got so much research. They go very in depth. And honestly, they do it 10 times better than I could. So I'm just going to give you an overview. And if you'd like to know more,
please. That'd be a whole nother episode.
Yeah, it would be. That would be a whole other episode in itself. So please go watch that, because it is truly fascinating. And I'm not saying that I don't believe in it, but I'm also saying that I don't believe in it.
Okay.
So I'm very on the fence.
Right.
In 1979, Berkowitz mailed a book about witchcraft to police in North Dakota. He had underlined several passages and written in a few marginal notes, including the phrase, "Arliss Perry hunted, stalked, and slain, followed to California, Stanford University." The reference was to Arliss Perry, a 19-year-old North Dakota newlywed who had been murdered at Stanford on October 12, 1974. Her death and the notorious abuse of her corpse in a chapel on campus was a widely reported case. So, long story short of Arliss's horrific death, and sorry, trigger warning, this whole episode is a trigger warning, but this especially. Arliss was found in a chapel on campus underneath some pews. She was found with altar candles stuck in certain orifices of her body, including her vagina. Mm-hmm. She was clearly beaten and mutilated and assaulted and all, like, the most awful things pre and post mortem. It's just, like, really, really horrendous.
Right.
Absolute, like, horrible, horrible people did this to her.
Right.
Like, awful. The worst of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So Berkowitz mentioned the Perry attack in other letters, suggesting that he knew details of it from the perpetrator himself. Local police investigators in North Dakota interviewed him, but they, quote, now, in 2004, believe that he has nothing of value to offer. That was the last time that they interviewed him, was in 2004.
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't clear.
Right.
The Arliss Perry case was solved in 2018.
Okay.
The Arliss Perry case is still unsolved to this day. After his admission to Sullivan Prison, Berkowitz began to claim that he had joined a satanic cult in the spring of 1975. In 1993, Berkowitz made these claims known when he announced to the press that he had killed only three of the Son of Sam victims: Donna Loria, Alexander Esau, and Valentina Suriani. In his revised version of the events, Berkowitz said that other shooters were involved and that he had only fired the gun at his first attack with Donna and Jody, and the sixth with Alexander and Valentina. Which I find interesting, the first and the sixth. Like, then did they rotate? I don't know. He said that he and other several cult members were involved in every incident by planning the events, providing early surveillance of the victims, and acting as lookouts and drivers to the crime scenes. Berkowitz stated that he could not divulge the names of most of his accomplices without putting his family directly at risk. Like, his father was still alive at this point, and he was terrified that they were going to go murder his father.
Right.
Among Berkowitz's alleged unnamed associates was a female cult member who he claims fired the gun at Carl Donato and Rosemary Keenan, both of whom survived. Berkowitz said that the alleged accomplice was unfamiliar with the powerful recoil of the .44 Bulldog. Berkowitz declared that at least five cult members were at the scene of the Christine Freund and John Deal shooting, but the actual shooter was a predominant cult associate who had been brought from outside New York with an unspecified motive. A cult member who he only identified by his nickname, Manson 2, in reference to Charles Manson.
Right.
Another unnamed person was the gunman of the Stacy Moskowitz Robert Valente case, a male cult member who had arrived from North Dakota for the occasion, also without explanation. Berkowitz did name two of the cult members, John and Michael Carr, the two men of the sons of the dog owner Sam Carr, and they lived nearby on Warburn Avenue. Both of these other Sons of Sams were long dead. John Carr had been killed in a shooting judged as a suicide in North Dakota during 1978, and Michael Carr had been in a fatal car accident in 1979. In the documentary, they talk about how both of these men had previous conversations to their death to, like, allude to the fact that they were a part of this cult,
mm-hmm.
and investigators do believe... Well, like, Maury Terry definitely believes that because they were maybe going to talk, that's why they were killed.
Right.
Berkowitz claimed that the perpetrator of the Donna DeMasi, Joanne Lomino shooting was John Carr, and he added that the Yonkers police officer, also a cult member, was involved in this crime. He claimed that Michael Carr fired the shots at Sal Lupo and Judy Placido. Author Maury Terry wrote that Michael Carr was a very active Scientologist who had traveled to Scientology's Mecca in Clearwater, Florida, which we've discussed before. Mm-hmm. According to Terry, at the time of Berkowitz's arrest, he was in possession of a list of telephone numbers, including the number of Scientology's Fort Harrison Hotel facility in Clearwater. Journalist John Hockenberry asserted that even though from the satanic cult claims, many officials doubted the single shooter theory, writing, quote, "What most we don't know about the Son of Sam case is that from the beginning, not everyone thought the idea Berkowitz acted alone," unquote. Mm-hmm. NYPD officer Richard Johnson, involved in the original investigations, optioned that unresolved discrepancies in statements from witnesses and surviving victims indicate Berkowitz did not act alone. Which is what I was discussing earlier. Quote, "Why were there three suspect cars, five different suspect descriptions, different heights, different shapes, different sizes of the perpetrator? Somebody else was there," unquote. Other contemporaries voiced the belief in the satanic cult theory, including Donna Loria's father and Carl DeNaro, who stated his opinion that, quote, "more than one person was involved," unquote, but admitted that he could not prove the cult theory. Carl DeNaro is a huge believer in the cult theory. Mm. Or at least, if it's not a cult, he did not act alone.
Right.
Carl's conclusion rests on the criticism of Berkowitz's statement to the police as totally false. John Deal's recollection that he physically bumped into Berkowitz outside the Wine Gallery restaurant as he and Christine Freund departed and walked to his car where the shooting occurred. Berkowitz, in contrast, told police that he had passed within a few feet of John and Christine shortly before they entered the car. John contends that he and Christine passed no one on their way to the car, and further that the placement of the car parked at the curb would have made it impossible for Berkowitz to have snuck up on them in the few minutes between their encounter outside the restaurant and the shooting at the car. John thus reasons he was shot by someone other than Berkowitz. There was just like physically no way that he could have. And no offense, David Berkowitz is no spring chicken, even right. though he was a spring chicken. He was 24 when he got arrested, right. by the way.
Yeah.
Wild. But even then, he was not really a spring chicken.
Mm-hmm.
So it just doesn't really make a lot of sense unless mm-hmm. there is a weird timeline discrepancy, which right. there could be.
Yeah.
Hockenberry's report was given much exposure by Dateline NBC in 2004. He discussed journalist Maury Terry, who began investigating the Son of Sam shootings before Berkowitz was arrested. Terry published a series of investigated articles in the Gannett newspapers in 1975, which challenged the official explanation of a lone gunman. Vigorously denied by the police at the time, Terry's articles were widely read and discussed, and they were later assembled in book form as The Ultimate Evil. Largely implied by these reports of accomplices and satanic cult theory, the Son of Sam case was reopened by Yonkers police during 1996. But no new charges were filed. Due to a lack of findings, the investigation was eventually suspended, but remains open. From prison, Berkowitz continued to assert and expand upon his claims of demonic possession. He states in a series of 9 videos in 2005 that the voice that he heard was that of Sam Hain, a druid devil, and the true origin of Son of Sam. Sam Hain is also a part of, like, Celtic mythology as well. Mm-hmm. And, like, pagan religion, too. Mm-hmm. It's actually part of the reason why we have Halloween.
Favorite holiday.
I love Halloween. Me too. He added that it was never a dog, saying that that detail was fabricated by the media. Berkowitz's later claims were dismissed by many. Newspaper columnist Jimmy Breslin rejected his story of satanic cult accomplices, stating that, quote, "when they talked to Berkowitz that night, he recalled everything step by step. The guy has 1,000% That guy has 1,000% recall, and that's that. He's the guy, and there's nothing else to look at," unquote. Skeptics included former FBI profiler John E. Douglas, who we've spoken of before, who spent hours interviewing Berkowitz. He stated he was convinced Berkowitz acted alone and was an introverted loner not capable of being involved in any group activity, unquote. NYPD psychologist Dr. Harvey Sloshenberg stated in Against the Law, a documentary about the Son of Sam case, that he believes that the satanic cult claims are nothing but a fantasy concocted by Berkowitz to absolve himself of the crimes. And that, my friends, is the case of David Berkowitz, aka the Son of Sam.
Shoo! Good job.
I'm tired.
You killed it. That was a lot.
I am tired.
Me too.
Well, yeah. Thanks again for listening to me. Of course. Well, just like on all of our longer form episodes, we always like to do some recommendations at the end. Mm-hmm. As a little palate cleanser.
Yeah.
Ray, do you want to go first with...
Sure. I actually, like I had told you, I haven't been watching a ton of TV lately. I've just been doing all the things. But there is something that I want to watch that has been recommended to me a lot. So maybe you guys can watch it with me. And that is on Netflix. It's called Manifest.
Ooh, yeah, and it's on my list too.
Yeah, I've heard about that one. So basically the gist of it that it says is when a plane mysteriously lands years after takeoff. I think it's like, so they land and it's 5 years in the future from when they took off on the plane. Ooh. So obviously some kind of time-space continuum type thing. The people on board return to a world that has moved on without them and face strange new realities. And it's apparently very good. It's number two in the U.S. today on Netflix. There's two seasons so far, and I've heard really good things about it. So I'm excited to hopefully start watching it soon.
Come on, Manifest.
Yeah, we love manifesting in this house.
Work.
Full moon this week. I didn't even know. Thanks for letting me know.
You're welcome. My recommendation for this week is to watch, it's not necessarily lighthearted.
Right.
But
well, that's okay.
It's really fantastic. It's called Inside. It's Bo Burnham's new comedy special.
I want to watch that.
I have watched it twice. It is
so good.
Euphoric and soul crushing and so well done. It is truly a work of art through the lens of comedy. And I don't say that to sound like a pretentious butthole, but it really is that. Like, that man is a genius, and I will fight anybody who says otherwise. Verbally, not physically. I'm a lover, not a fighter. I've never had anyone explain their COVID experience in such a close way of what I felt like going through quarantine and the pandemic. I mean, we're still in it, but
right.
Coming
we're
out of it.
We're seeing the light.
Yeah. So it's, that is something really special. And I've literally been telling everybody to watch it.
Yeah. No, I totally want to watch it.
It's really, really fantastic.
I've heard good things and yeah. It's definitely on my list.
You can find us on Instagram and TikTok at The Midnight Record, yes. Twitter at TMR Pod, mm-hmm. and you can always email us via Gmail
themidnightrecord@gmail.com. That's it. That's us. That's where you can find us.
All of us.
Shoot us a line.
Rate, review, and subscribe.
Yes. Send us stories, recommendations, requests, just notes to see how our day's going.
Notes of adoration.
Yes. Fan mail. Like devotions.
Devotion. Yes, we would also like devotions.
Yes.
No, you don't have to send us devotions. Just making sure that you have rate, reviewed, and subscribed and are listening to every episode is just plenty enough for
and
us.
And share so. Each episode with at least 10 people or else.
Thanks for joining us once again.
Thanks.
We'll see you next week. Be yeah. well, stay safe. Until next time.
See you at midnight.
I'll see you at midnight.
Peace.
It's almost midnight.
We gotta go to bed.